Tonight we're going to talk about biography, and a casual poll of my own acquaintances indicates that while everybody loves to read biographies, there are plenty of people who wouldn't like to be the subject of one. So I'm going to keep the introductions pretty short. Hilary Sperling, who, my favorite fact, born on Christmas Day, was a literary editor at The Spectator and is the author of biography of Ivy Compton Burnett, another of Paul Scott, and another, the most recent, first volume of Matisse, The Unknown Matisse. And Jeremy Chaglone, who is a familiar face, is a professor here, has had a lot of other teaching posts and fellowships, was at the Times Literary Supplement in London for 10 years, where he was the editor for most of that time, and the author of a biography of Roald Dahl, and the most recent one, Romancing, the Life and Work of Henry Green. I'm Catherine Bucknell, and I've edited Auden's Juvenilia for Faber and Faber, and I'm working on Christopher Isherwood's diaries now. So I'm not really a biographer, but I'm greatly interested in it. Biography, history of a life, might start by saying X was born on a bright June morning in 1933. One of the things I noticed about all of these biographies is they don't start that way. So I'd like to ask Hilary and Jeremy to read out the first sentence or two of either, we could do all of the books, or we could just do, you know, your preference, one or two of them, just to read out a first sentence and to say very briefly, when in the course of research or writing did you think, this is the sort of sentence that I'm going to begin this book with? Would you go first?
I can't remember how I began any of my biographies, so I shall read the first sentence, whatever that may be, of my last book, because I'll probably be able to remember better how I wrote it. And I may say I do start a book with the first sentence and I write right through to the last sentence and I do not do a second draft. So for me, it's rather important where I start. And this book I see began, Henri Matisse often compared his development as a painter to the growth of a seed. It's like a plant, this is a quote, it's like a plant that takes off once it's firmly rooted, he said, looking back at the end of his life. The root presupposes everything else. Well, I think I chose that quote because I had to start. My book is called The Unknown Matisse, and I was hoping to completely reverse the legend of Matisse. If any of you have any idea of the kind of person Matisse was, it is almost certainly that of a stuffy, boring, humorless, shrewd, and somewhat grasping human being. Not a very obliging picture. That was the picture painted for me by the Matisse experts, the art historians. And when I, the idea of writing a life of Matisse, this is the first biography there has ever been of Matisse, was proposed to me by my publisher, and I could see what a wonderful idea, I mean, what a history of the 20th century that would be, but I had enough to sense to say to him, no, I mean, you're crazy. Either somebody's done it or somebody's working on it, and in any case, I've never written about a painter, it's not for me. And it took about a year for him to persuade me that no one had ever done it, that nobody was working on it anywhere in France, in America, or here. And with one sort of saving shred of sanity, I wrote, no, I didn't, I sent a message through a mutual friend to England's leading Matisse expert, whom I didn't then know, but we had a friend in common, to say, could this be true? I couldn't believe it. And the answer came back, yes, it is true. There's never been a biography of Matisse. Nobody is working on one. And if she wants to know why there's never been a biography, tell her that Matisse's life would be too dull to write about. Well, at that point, this was 10 years ago, I thought, I certainly was no Matisse expert then, but I am a biographer. I've been one all my life. I've spent my life studying other people's lives, poking and prying, as a Ivy Compton Burnett, my first subject, said. And I just could not believe this. I could not believe that someone who had painted pictures so full of life and energy and force could possibly have been a dull man or led a boring life. So that actually was the turning point for me. That's what decided me, that ill-qualified though I was, not an art historian, not French, and a woman, which, you know, in many spheres is disqualifying as well, and certainly it is in France, I still would try, would throw my hat in the ring, as it were. And actually, well, that was, I think, the most nerve-wracking ordeal of my entire life, and for 2 years I really hardly slept. It was appalling. I mean, it was very, very hard for me to get through that time because I was backing my own hunch against all the experts, the world's experts, on Matisse, and I was also mortgaging a whole stretch of my life, and I had no idea what I might find, but I knew from the beginning, or at least, well, I knew I could not believe their story. So I set out in search of what I called to myself my unknown Matisse from the very beginning, but I had absolutely no idea what I might find. In fact, in the end, though it took me a long time, nature did give me a sensational plot. I mean, really, the story of Matisse's life is quite, totally unlike what anybody expected, but also it is, well, literally sensational. Sometimes I felt I was writing as if I was writing a thriller. I reached several points at which I could hardly believe it myself. I had to keep touching base. Checking with these art experts, all of whom told me, no, they had no idea of any of this. And I may say they have very sweetly eaten their words in the end. That was another thing that I found extremely nerve-wracking, to tell a whole lot of people, the leading experts in a particular field, that you think they're totally wrong, and then to try to prove them totally wrong. I thought as anybody would imagine, that they would show me off in no uncertain manner, and then I would get a really savage drubbing when my book came out. But I think it speaks extremely well for the art historical profession that actually, on the contrary, they've been nothing but generous to me from start to finish. Anyway, to go back to why I wrote that first sentence, it was because I was about to embark on a description of Matisse's roots, where he came from, which were so unlike what anybody would have guessed or imagined, that I thought I needed at least some, as it were, walking stick to hold, and that my man's own words might be the best way. And so that's why I began my book the way I did.
That's wonderful. Jeremy, would you read us a sentence and tell us about it?
Okay, yeah, I'll read you two sentences. And the reason for doing that is that the reviewer in the FT said this book began with the most boring sentence he'd ever read. But the next sentence was actually pretty good, and after that it kept up that high standard. There's a very fine discrimination that this reviewer has. You'll be able to tell me whether you think he's right. This is the first sentence. The River Severn meanders around the York estate in Gloucestershire between Forthampton Court, the big old house where one of the families still lives, and the abbey town of Tewkesbury. To my mind, this slides naturally and without too strong a sense of a change of gear into the next sentence. On sleepy summer evenings in the 1910s, Vincent and Maud York's youngest son, Henry, would sit in a boat fishing a safe distance from his intimidatingly energetic and clever elder brothers, and a few yards from working men who had cycled out of the town to fish from the meadow bank opposite. He imagined, as he later wrote, I'm actually treating this as the third sentence, that between him and the men there was something conspiratorial hunched over our floats as shadows began to stretch out long over the surface of the water. It wasn't the... I write endless new drafts, so that I sometimes feel that the book, I'm a novice in this area, I've only written two biographies, but I sometimes feel that it's, as some artists say about works of art, it's abandoned rather than finished. I sort of do so many different versions, I could give you, about 10 different biographies of Henry Greene, so I'm quite the opposite of you in that way. And I think that in any case, every biography and most narratives actually have quite a few beginnings in them. There's the beginning you referred to, which is the birthday, mm-hmm. which every life story has somewhere, and usually pretty early on. There's the beginning, which in the case of the life of an artist or of a writer is to do with a seminal moment related to their work. There's the beginning, which is the hook to the reader, which may be one or other of those, or maybe something different, as it is, I hope, here. And there's the beginning, which actually you didn't read out and I haven't read out, which comes before that beginning. It's the preface, where you very often say something really rather important about how you view what you've been doing and why you've been doing it in this way and how it relates to your subject. So there are several beginnings. But the beginning I began with for this book actually was from Henry Green's Who's Who entry, where he is characteristically evasive and elusive and tells you nothing about himself while giving you all the facts that are required by Who's Who. But suddenly, under recreations, as it were, blurts out, romancing over the bottle to a good band. And that's where I got my title from, of course, and where in so many ways Green reveals himself. So I sort of restart the book a few pages on with that. But the reason I began with the river and his home family estate is actually to do with symmetry and the shaping of a whole narrative, which I imagine we'll be talking about a bit. The book ends with his going back to Forthampton to be buried. It's a place about which he had the intensest feelings and about which he wrote wonderfully, both factually and in his fiction, but which he left decisively when he went to work in a factory in Birmingham, his family's factory, in his early 20s, and never returned to. He then lived in London, married, and was a London person who hated going back to Forthampton until he went back to be buried there. So I wanted that that circular feeling, mm-hmm, and most of the rest of the book doesn't happen there.
We have a river and a seed, so these two beautifully natural, organic sort of metaphors, and there is this oblique, impressionistic way of approaching the subject, avoiding dates and facts. It seemed to me that you both take your principles about the shape of the particular book somehow from the subject of the book. And we were talking earlier about Matisse and portraiture, and I thought perhaps you would tell a little bit about the book as a portrait and how you derived that, particularly from Matisse, and perhaps, you know, for another subject, you'd use a set of rules that wasn't from Matisse, but from that subject. I feel that you do that as well with, deriving from your... If you would tell us a little bit about Matisse and those rules of portraiture.
Well, I felt, as I just explained to you, particularly exposed when I began this biography. I had no idea what I might find. It was a field I didn't know about. It was a field nobody knew about, actually, as it turned out. And all my research was to be done in France. And when I, very naively, at the beginning, I thought there aren't many things that the English do better than the French. But one of them most definitely is biography. And maybe one could cross the channel, give them a few tips, you know, which was, as it turned out, a ridiculous attitude to take. The reason the French don't write biography is not because they can't, but because they won't. They despise it, absolutely. For them, it is the intellectual pits. I understood that very early because I could see the effect it had when anybody asked me why I was trying to find out about whatever I was trying to find out about, and I would say because I'm... The minute I mentioned the word biography or biographer, their faces fell a mile. You know, you could see that. Not so much in Paris, where people are more sophisticated and much more skilled in concealing their feelings, but in provincial France, it was very, very clear. So I quickly learned never to mention the word of biography. I would say my researcher, or mes travaux, or something like that. And then things went better. And I was confirmed in this. Quite recently in Paris, I had lunch with a friend of mine, a young and very, very bright art historian whom I'd met some while before. And, I mean, I'd met him quite early on. He's written one or now two books and done several very good exhibitions on Matisse. So he, too, was working in the same field as me and using many of the same materials, and we became... He then He came to Oxford, and so, of course, and he was very nervous about that. I said, don't be nervous, the English. He said, they will despise me totally, in his rather elegant French accent. I said, they won't despise you, whatever other attitude they may take to you. They may not be nice to you, but they won't despise you. English people don't despise French intellectuals. But he was building from his own experience, in which the French certainly do despise English intellectuals, so he couldn't. Anyway, I saw him through all that, and all I'm saying is we became quite attached. And so free did he finally feel with me that earlier this year we were having lunch in Paris, and he said to me, you know, one of the things you said to me when we first met, this was 9 years ago, I have never forgotten. I thought, extraordinary, can I have said something so witty, so sharp about Matisse that he never forgot it? I said, what was that then, Rémy? And he said, what you said was that you were a biographer and you weren't ashamed of it. I thought, well, he's come to trust me quite a lot to be able to let down his defences to that extent. So, as I say, I was very exposed when I first went to France, and when I therefore composed my preface, which I don't know if that's the same with all biographers, I should think it may well be, is actually the thing you write last. You write the book, and then you kind of look at what you've done, and you give some sort of explanation of it, or some gloss to it. My preface was composed for the French, and once again I thought, well, I will couch it in terms that they must understand. I will take as my text. And as a matter of fact, I had, because I had to do a frightening thing for this book, something I've never had to do before. I had to write a preface for a proposal for American publishers. This is actually a far, if any of you, or when any of you come to write a biography. I do warn you that this is by far the worst ordeal you're ever going to have to face, writing the American proposal. It's as long as a book, it has chapters, it has chapter headings. It's ghastly. Anyway, I remember couching I read Matisse's essays on portraiture, and Matisse is a wonderful and extremely lucid writer about art. He didn't write much, but what he did is very, very clear. And I took his own instructions as to how to paint a portrait. Because the crazy thing about writing a proposal for a biography, certainly the kind of biography I write, where nobody knows anything about the subject and where you're first in the field, the kind that Jeremy writes to, is, of course, you don't know what you're going to find out. And there's no point finding it out if there's not going to be a book in the end. Why give several years of your life to it? So it's an impossible thing to do. And I simply couched this. I took Matisse's instructions and put them in my proposal and said, this is what I plan to do. I shall follow his instructions. And having finished the book, I was surprised to see that is precisely what I had done. One of the things he said, and Matisse, I think, was a great portrait painter, and especially a great drawer of portraits. He made astonishing portrait drawings all his life. He said, you should start absolutely without preconceptions. And I must say, this is, for me, has always been a cardinal rule of biography. And, well, that is the thing with which you begin, I think. And he also said, you must invent nothing. You must look intensely, very, very closely at the face, well, in his case, a face, in my case, a life that is before you. And that's all you can do, study it with absolute and extreme scrupulosity. And he then said, in the third place, that the quality of a portrait depends on the quality of the attention that has been focused on it, the delicacy and subtlety and force of attention you've been able to bring to it. Well, that's something one can't control. I mean, you can concentrate all you like and be as subtle as you can. You may not be subtle enough, but that's just because you aren't a subtle enough person. But I still think that those are, for me, the three cardinal rules of biography. And in Matisse's case, I followed each exactly, and I use that as my screen and shield when I come before the French critical courts, which will be next spring. And I'm perfectly sure I shall be shot out of the ground. It will be an appalling experience. But I still use as my weapons Matisse's very precise instructions as to how to make a portrait, which I followed exactly. And the portrait, oh, and he further said that when you make a portrait following these rules, you are very often surprised by the results. You discover from the portrait things you didn't know you knew, things you wouldn't have expected about this person in front of you. And that, too, for me, has always been true of every biography I've written, and of this biography particularly, in that the things I discovered have just surprised, astounded everybody.
Jeremy, do you have, are there particular things that you learned from Roald Dahl or from Henry Green that you put to use consciously in how you went about doing it?
I think it's a very interesting question, and I've been so interested listening to Hilary talking about that and some of the related things she's been saying. I mean, I want to come at it sort of slightly sideways through some of the things she said, if I may. By the way, I've never minded writing proposals for American publishers, but actually retranslating this book from American back into English after the American editors had been at work on it was really quite an ordeal. Finding that jugged hare, which is, I think, an unambiguous dish, whether you like it or not, had been translated into stewed rabbit, which is really quite another concept. I'm also interested, I mean, Americans do biography well and like biography, and I'm wondering whether there's something, if one can venture a sort of incredibly crude and broad national set of generalizations, whether there's something to do with Protestant cultures, cultures which have been dominantly Protestant, that lends itself to biography because of the stress on the individual, and cultures which have been predominantly Catholic or strongly Catholic, which somehow resists it. But it's not only in France that you meet this resistance, or in ex-Catholic countries or Catholic countries, and the whole sort of continental European approach to biography, I think, is interesting. And there are oppositions to it in other quarters, of course, as a genre. In English literary studies, it's not, on the whole, highly valued. Indeed, there has been a whole doctrine that you should not take any account of writers in thinking about literary work, that writers must be regarded as having excluded themselves from their work. And then there's the other kind of hostility to biography, which you've encountered as well as I, which comes from people who are closely connected with people you're going to put in the book, who don't want you to write about it. I think I'm maybe one of the few biographers who's had a one-man fatwa aimed at him. The son of Henry Green actually said at one stage, "Well, I don't know what I can do. I'm just going to have to come and shoot you." And since he's got a large shotgun, which he uses, I've seen him use it, I was momentarily a little intimidated by that. So there are all these hostilities to the form that I suppose press on one in different ways, and perhaps make one seek protection or intimacy all the more in what one's subject is and how one's subject might think about the process of writing a life or portraying a person. And I think that what I found myself doing is, and I guess everybody does who writes biographies, is half doing it, doing my book, and half, I mean, not in these proportions, partly doing my book and partly doing my subject's book and thinking about it through my subject's thoughts and approaches. In this case, obviously, the way that Henry Green himself approached narrative. Now, in style, my book couldn't be more different from his, but there's something about his obliquity and his reticence that I think has found its way into my book, which makes it very different from the book about Roald Dahl. For example, I mean, and it has been aided and abetted by the fact that there was some material that I wasn't allowed access to. But I think that came out, I hope it came out, in a way that's sort of expressive of him. He had an affair throughout most of his marriage with his wife's sister. He actually said to Alan Ross, who was a younger friend of his, that if Alan Ross was going to get married, he should choose somebody who had a very pretty sister, because it saved a lot of trouble. Now, I make that... to me, that this is quite clear in the book. But it's pretty reticently handled. And I think that that's something to do with my feeling that's how it should be handled in relation to Henry Green. I didn't want to make some big, you know, by the way, I hope you've noticed he was also having it off with his sister-in-law statement. So there are these obliquities and as I say, reticences in it.
Let's go back to what you said about Protestant Catholic culture, the rise of the individual. Such an interesting idea also, and trying to consider why biography is now so popular, particularly in this country, whether it's to do with a decline in interest in sort of official history or the growth of psychology or a growth in the interest in the inner life. These are all artists, and I wonder whether we're interested in trying to understand what genius is because we want to bring it down to earth, or are biographers trying somehow to bridge a gap that's grown up between the arts and the common man, if such a thing exists, and help us all to get more understanding, more pleasure from that. I feel there's a sort of 19th century myth about, you know, the artists shocking the middle classes and rushing away from the middle classes and so on, but as a biographer, if you try to reach out to that, you're then bringing the artist back almost into confrontation with this, the middle classes. Jeremy, what do you think about the idea of genius and...
Well, I'm not very interested in the idea of genius. I am interested in qualitative comparisons between artists and the relative degrees of interest of people, if you like. I'm not sure that I know what genius means, but I think there are more exceptional and less exceptional artists and people. I think there's something in what you say about the bringing down to earth. I mean, Dryden said that one of the reasons you like reading A Life of Augustus is that you see him playing cockle shells with his children. I don't think that's a reductive appetite, but it's an appetite for intimacy with greatness. And one of the things, thinking about what you're talking about the sort of democratic side of things, that biography does, is to bring any of us into close contact with rather exceptional people and the way they work. I think, too, that by the way, I don't think the popularity of the genre is new. I mean, the fact that Dryden was interested in it, that Isaac Walton wrote it, that Samuel Johnson wrote it, that it was a huge thing in the 19th century, suggests to me that this is something the English have always done pretty well and have always been interested in. But there is something to do with bridging the gap between not only greatness and ordinariness, the greatness of the subject, if it is a great subject, and the ordinariness of the reader, but also, as you were suggesting, between kinds of thinking about the arts, if we're talking about lives of artists and writers. And one of the things I've always been passionately interested in is trying to help to close the gap between how the arts are talked about in universities and sealed off professional groups and how they're understood by ordinary readers out there. And to me, biography is the perfect form from that point of view, because it's the only form of literary history or literary criticism that has a non-academic readership in this country. Does that answer any of your questions?
Yeah, no, that's incredibly interesting. I was just thinking again about that seed and Matisse and the idea of the creative process and how you might be able to try and understand or express that as a sort of mystery, as it is with the seed, that there is this accretion of detail in the telling of the life, and it somehow to convey that magic or that mystery of the transformation into, you know, that light that is so evident even in the illustrations in your Matisse book. Can you tell us a little bit about the difficulties of that, of trying to get from the detail to that magic and that bigger picture?
I think ultimately every human life is a mystery, and you cannot ever completely explain anything. You can get as close as you can, and I've tried to do it 3 times, and all I know is I've come as close as I could to the heart of that mystery, but certainly I think it probably isn't possible to penetrate it ultimately, or to expose it. But I think one can examine it and explore it and to some extent provide clues that help to penetrate closer to the heart of that mystery. And I think biography is actually a very, very subtle historical instrument. And at this particular moment, one of the roles that it's taken on is of enabling people to penetrate history, because historians themselves have either become very general and very populist and not really on the whole cutting edge anymore, or, I mean, that's despised by more specialist historians, or they have become so specialised, so detailed, so minute, that it's very hard for the general reader to follow them, and not terribly interesting either. Whereas biography is a focus that you can bring to bear either on a whole century. In the case of A Life of Matisse, it is in a sense a story of the 20th century, because everybody, whether or not they've ever seen a picture or a reproduction of a picture by Matisse, nonetheless have been affected by the visual discoveries that he made. He changed the way. He was one of the people that changed the way in which we look at things. That is indisputable. So in a sense, to follow through the story of his life and his work is telling one strand of the story of the 20th century. And that's what's always particularly interested me, because it's my century. I mean, it's all of our century. It's the world we live in. And I think to try to understand some of the forces that shaped it, well, for me, it's been a consuming passion, and the form it's taken is following various lives through that century. But there is also, as Jeremy said, a very, well, in the end, perhaps metaphysical, but also very touching and human aspect to biography, which history at its best can also have, but doesn't always have. And that is that however extraordinary any man or woman's achievements may have been, however unimaginable, however difficult to conceive, however astounding when you're confronted by them, and I'm actually talking about paintings or books, literature or art, because that's the world that's most affected me and that I've written about, however astonishing it may be what somebody has done, nonetheless, there is always one thing you have in common with that person, which is that we are all human, that these are human beings that have pushed imagination, imaginative achievement, to the furthest limits that they were capable of and that in their life had been reached. And if one, as it were, accompanies them, tries to follow them, stand beside them, even perhaps see through their eyes, which is the ultimate aim of biography, and insofar as that's possible, that's what I try to do. I think it isn't always, I mean, it can never be fully possible. One is, as it were, raising oneself to their level, or at any rate trying to see what they saw. And I've always written about artists whom I think were very remarkable, extremely original, who saw what other people didn't see, what later generations may have found much easier to see because these individuals first saw it. And therefore, biography itself on its, almost its do I mean its metaphysical level? At any rate, it has a level at which I think we, this is Richard Holmes, is another, a great biographer of our own day, his image, well, he has had many, he's used many images for biography, but the one that I find most moving is when he describes the biographer in his book on Johnson and Savage as a latter-day, a contemporary Charon, the ferryman who ferried souls across the river of limbo from life into death and back again. The biographer ferries them back again. Well, that is certainly a function that any biographer must always have felt, that in a sense the dead, especially the unknown or the ignored or the misunderstood dead, call out to us. And you can only answer one call, but you can, to the best of your ability, do that. And I think that's a very, for me, a very strong motive. I would have thought for all good biographers that, you know, we can touch the past very clearly, very nearly, very closely through the function of biography. Well, that's just one of its faculties.
That's a side which is very, you've spoken about it very powerfully, and it seems to sort of relate almost to sort of saints' lives and that early tradition of biography. But I was just thinking about something you were saying earlier, Kate, about your work on Isherwood and on Auden, and finding that Auden had been reading Goodbye to Berlin at a particular point when he was writing a particular group of poems, and mm-hmm. being convinced that there's a direct influence going in there. And of also of reading the fascinating things that you have to reveal in your life of Matisse about Matisse at art school and the actual practicalities of what he had to do and what he hated doing, what was imposed on him, and what he actually got from it. And apart from all the sort of things that are to do with one's awe and reverence for artists, there's also the sort of sheer practical, how is it done fascination. You know, yeah. what actually went into the, how, what were the processes by which this work was done, this training was made and done and achieved. We all share, I'm sure, that sort of terrific excitement when you get into a box of, in an archive, a box that nobody else has looked at, or not properly, of letters or proofs or a manuscript for a work, and you know you're going to find something there that reveals to you how something was actually made. And I've always been, and I expect we have it all in common, fascinated by any kind of writing that helps to convey the process of the making of a work simultaneously with something about the quality of the work. I remember, I mean, another writer about artists whom I admire very much is Tim Hilton, and I just remember reading him say about a painter he admires, Gillian Ayres, that her work has a lot of wrist in it. And I immediately sort of knew something about the physical process, which is so important in painting, and could see something about the texture of the paint. So it told me something about how she worked and also something about how her paintings looked. Do you see what I mean? That the actual practicalities, demystifying the practicalities is interesting.
I think there's always this kind of inner drive that you think this person is going through life, making a decision, behaving in a certain way, certain actions, and one wants always to say, why at this moment did they do this? Did they produce this work? What is the continuing motivation? And interestingly, Auden is one of those artists who very often would put into the work of the imagination the alternative thing that he would never dream of doing in life, the use of fantasy, which in sometimes means that it can be a terrible mistake to take from the work something and go back to the life with it and say, oh, this must have happened, or could this have been going on? One of the things I wanted to ask you both was how you guard against hunches and conjectures and those sort of what-if moments when, as I was saying to you before, if you get on a roll and you think you really are, you know, have discovered something, how you keep yourself calmed down and really on the facts without giving up the excitement of it could have been this, it, you know, it must have been that. As you're working, you know, as you're trying to solve these mysteries.
Personally, I think the hunch is perhaps the biographer's key tool. I mean, without it, where would I be? For instance, my hunch at the very beginning, when I thought I couldn't possibly write the life of Matisse, I still had a hunch that they couldn't be right. I mean, that was what really forced me to do it, and my hunch turned out to be right. But I'll tell you a story of another hunch. This was when I was writing the life of Paul Scott, the man who wrote The Jewel and the Crown, which became, after he died, a very successful television series, but in his lifetime it was an almost totally unsuccessful series of books, because India was not a subject about which the English wished to think, and certainly not the end of the Indian Empire, which he had explored in a series of very powerful novels. Anyway, I was writing his life and jogging along, and I had a few hunches. Some seemed to be borne out, some didn't. And I discovered to my, dismay really, that the basic cache of his papers were in the University of Tulsa, Oklahoma, a place to which I had never been. And when I mentioned to my American friends, as a matter of fact, I'd never been to America then. I don't know how, I couldn't understand how I'd reached that great age without ever going to America, so I was pleased about that one. But when I mentioned to my American friends I was going to Tulsa, Oklahoma, they all said, ah, nah, not Tulsa, Oklahoma. I have to say I did love it. But when I got there, they told me there were 12,000 documents in their archives. Well, what do you allow? How long is 12,000 documents? How long is it going to take you to read? I allowed 6 weeks. And I went there and I read them all. And by this time, I was well enough advanced. I mean, I'd been working on the book, I suppose, for a year or two. I knew that there was a missing piece in my jigsaw. I talked to an awful lot of people who knew Paul Scott. I'd explored all really available sources in his in England and London, where he lived. I'd discussed things and discovered a great deal about his family. And the more I knew, the more I realized that I was not going to be able to make sense of this life. There was something missing. I had innumerable pieces. I thought, well, never mind, when I get to Tulsa, I'll find out. So I went there and I read all these 12,000 letters, documents, manuscripts, scraps of diary. They were the entire contents of his study when he died, and he was a man who never threw anything away, and very interesting they were. But I was none the wiser at the end. My missing piece was still missing. By this time, I'd spent too long, I'd put too much energy into this life not to write it, and yet I couldn't make head or tail of it. And at this point, I fell back on a hunch. I had a very strong hunch. Nothing I had read, certainly no document, bore this hunch out. On the contrary. But I knew there was some missing piece, and I thought that of all of his life, there was one period, I realized reviewing the material I'd got just to make sure I hadn't missed anything, there was one period, 18 months, at the beginning of the war, when Paul Scott had been conscripted into the army, and for 18 months he was in a British regiment as a private soldier before he was then drafted to go to India, which in the end for him was the key to his whole career as a writer and from which flowed his books and so forth. And of course by this time I'd been to India and I'd always known I would do that, and I found out a great deal there. But there was still this missing piece. I thought, well, the one period I know nothing about, that he never spoke about, never wrote about, never talked about to anyone, that nobody can talk to me about, was this first 18 months when he was in the army. And I just thought, I don't think it, if I'm right, if there is a missing key, it cannot be anywhere else, because I know too much about the rest of his life. It's strange, there should just be this one period. And I couldn't think of how I would discover what had happened in that period, because if you think of the beginning of the war, he was conscripted, therefore he's thrown among, as a private soldier, training as a private soldier in England. He's thrown among people he's never met before. The War Office doesn't keep records of conscripts, because it would basically be the male population of England, so no records exist. I couldn't therefore find who had been his contemporaries. His family knew nothing about it, of course, because by definition he wasn't with them. He was in basic training camp. His closest friend, with whom he had spent leaves, had died. And the rest of his friends dated from later, or his family from earlier. There was nobody who'd known him then. And so my hunch was that this was when it had happened. The only person I could think of to consult was the wife of his best friend, who was Australian and who was then living in Tasmania, a very old lady. So we corresponded, and she said, as people often do at the beginning of this biographical process, no, I don't know anything. I mean, I'd tell you anything I could, but I don't remember anything. So we corresponded for a while. And then I realized that since I was going to India, I have a very weak sense of geography, but even I could tell, if you go to India, you're kind of halfway to Australia. So I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, why don't I? I go on to Tasmania. So I did. That was not easy to arrange. It cost far more money and far more time than I possibly had to spend, but off I went. And I well remember arriving in Tasmania and meeting my hostess, who was a lady in her mid-80s, who turned out to be completely deaf, who was also a Quaker and teetotal. And I had bought for her from present from India, a peacock feather fan, totally unsuitable, and a bottle of Maharashtra champagne. These could not have been more unsuitable gifts. So I put them back in my case, and luckily I had a nice warm cashmere shawl and some packets of tea, which I gave her. And it was one of the strangest experiences of my life. I was there for 10 days. I'd wanted to stay in a hotel, but she said, no, I must stay with her, and insisted. So I went back to her house. We didn't meet anybody during these 10 days. We were encased in her house. Remember, she's completely deaf, so she can't. That actually turned out not to matter at all, because I wrote down my questions. After all, I'd come to ask her She hadn't come to, I mean, she wasn't there to listen to me. So I would write down any question I wanted, and she would then talk to me. And 10 days turned out to be just about enough. And anyway, we went into this strange retrospect, as strange for her as for me. I may say I now realize it is one of the standards. Period of the beginning of the war, when she had been married to a young poet, madly in love with him, and this other young poet, Paul Scott, the friend, had spent, first of all, the months when he was waiting for call-up with them. They'd been near neighbor. No, they'd been living in the same house, different flats. And then he spent all his leaves with them. And so this was a period that she hadn't thought about for, 40 years, would it be? I mean, it was 1940, and it was probably 82 or 3 when I was there. Nobody in Tasmania, of course, could she have discussed it with, because they wouldn't have known what she was talking about. Her husband was dead. She was recalling the most intense, the most exciting, the most passionate period of her whole life, partly that they read and wrote poetry the whole time, and partly also that they were waiting for their world to be blown apart, as indeed it was, by bombs, by conscription, by the army, by war. So it was a very, very intense 6 months. And somehow we recreated it. When I use the word séance, people don't like it. It's as though, but that so exactly describes what happened, and it's happened to me with every biography I've ever written. It's as though you were calling up ghosts. That is to say, her husband, Clive Sansom, a poet, and Paul Scott, then another young poet, those people were both dead. She and I thought and talked about them all day for 10 days, and it is as close as you can get. I hadn't thought of it before, but it's an almost physical illustration of what Richard Holmes said when he uses the image, the metaphor, of a biographer as the ferryman calling back the dead. We conjured up these people to such an extent that one day Ruth was laying the table for lunch, and she laid four places. I said, listen, there's two of us, you've laid four places. And she said she had laid for the dead. I mean, it was a completely unconscious thing, but we were so surrounded by these two. This, I don't know quite how it strikes you, but I have to say that this happened to me with my first biography, where Ivy Compton Burnett, who was one of 10 children, I think, the only two survivors were two of her sisters, who had also said to me at the beginning, by all means come and see us, but we can't tell you anything, we don't remember anything of that period, we haven't seen Ivy, I mean, for years, and we never talk about or think about that early stage. So I said, well, it would be a great pleasure for me to shake the hands of her sisters, and you know, in any case, I don't expect them, but I mean, if I may. And my first visit to them was the beginning of a series of sessions. I came once a month for, I think, 18 months. And my visits took a particular form dictated by them, but they were always the same. We would have tea in their house, and then we would cross the garden to their writing room, where they would sit down and say, ask us questions. We won't be able to answer them, but do. Please ask us questions. So I did. And it was as though we had opened a door on a world that they had not entered for 50 years. Their childhood had been as traumatic as Ivy's. And they had simply closed a door when they escaped finally from that family life. They were joint headmistresses of a school in King's Langley. And so, of course, they'd a very busy life, and they did not live in the past. And it was as though we opened a door and went into a country that we both knew well, because they had lived in that world of their childhood, of that extraordinary family, the Compton Burnett family. I didn't know anything about it, but I knew her books intimately. They had never read any of Ivy's novels. So it was as though we came upon this world from different angles, but it was the same world, because the world of Ivy's childhood, this very violent and traumatic family in which she lived, was reflected in her novels. I knew that. They had lived through it. So it was for both of us a quite extraordinary experience, and that too was like a séance. We were walking back, we were going back together into a world of the past.
Come back to Paul Scott and tell us the key to the 12,000 documents.
Oh, right. Yes, well, the key was that Paul was a very, a man much adored by his friends. And in the second half of his life, he became almost a recluse. But he remained a kind of father confessor for his friends. That's to say, people would write to him with their problems. And Paul was your ideal confidant. Instead of saying, if you write to him and say, oh my God, I'm in a terrible strait, this love affair's gone wrong, my marriage is a disaster, I've embezzled all the family, all the funds firms, instead of saying, you must leave this man, or give yourself up to the police, or giving any kind of advice like that, he would say, bear up, I'm with you, I feel for you, you know, exactly the kind of confidant you wanted. So that was what I read in the 12,000 documents. Many, many confidential life stories, and fascinating they were, but nothing about him. Meanwhile, many of his closest friends were women who had been very, very close to him, and so many women told me how madly in love they were with Paul Scott, that I abandoned my initial feeling, which was that there was a homosexual element here, but whenever I tried to discuss that with anyone, especially women who'd been very close to him, absolutely not. They completely dismissed it. His family the same. In fact, the secret was that he was a homosexual, but he had refused that in himself. He had denied it and he had closed it down. And of course, you can't actually do that without repercussions. And one of the sources of the power of his books, the depth of violence and brutality and malevolence in The Jewel in the Crown in the character of Ronald Merrick, comes absolutely from this dark side of Paul, which pursued him all his life, which tormented him, which made his life, I think, a tragic life, but also gave a tragic depth to his novels.
When did that suddenly click that you knew that was...
Well, I kind of knew it all along, but I'd had to drop it because everybody who knew him had said absolutely not. There was no question of that. In fact, there had been an episode in that first 18 months, I was right that that was the place to look, when he'd been discovered by the army authorities and punished for some sort of homosexual affair, and he had been so appalled, so sickened and so humiliated and so hated himself for this that he refused ever again to acknowledge it, and he remade himself. But of course you can't do that. You cannot exterminate part of yourself. He was tormented and paid a bitter price for it, but the advantage, in his novels, it gave a kind of an extra level, a tragic depth to those books, which I think would have been much harder to understand if I hadn't discovered it in him.
I want to just ask one more sort of short question and then open to questions from the audience. When you have something that, you know, a secret such as that to divulge, which in the year 2000 is a less startling thing and perhaps not causing the scandals that it might once have caused, is it possible that these kind of revelations or the too close scrutiny of the life of someone who's exercised particular decorums about their work and set up a particular public image in their art, in their public behavior, that the biographer risks destroying the reputation through doing a very good job? And is this something that we should be worried about, destroying the reputation, distracting attention from the work?
There is a problem there, and it became particularly evident, didn't it, with the life of Philip Larkin, which undoubtedly has harmed Larkin in the eyes of some readers, I hope temporarily, and I'm quite sure through no intention of the authors, but perhaps through some mishandling. I don't agree with Michael Holroyd, who said discretion is not the better part of biography. I think a biographer has to be as sensitive as any other kind of writer and has to be aware of the consequences of what he's writing. I don't mean in terms of concealment, but in terms of tact. This answer links with the hunch thing. I also absolutely believe in the importance of hunch. I found in first thinking about Henry Green, I spent a lot of time with his son until his son decided to shoot me. But one of the reasons I think the son decided he wanted to shoot me was that I was also spending a lot of time with somebody else whom he had sent me to see, who had been brought up by, who was the daughter of an East End girl, an artist model, and had been sort of semi-adopted by the person she lived with, who was Matthew Smith, the painter, a painter very indebted to Matisse, of course, and also from a background in the textile trade. Anyway, that's by the way. I kept going to see her and was very fascinated by her and by all she had to tell me about the milieu that Henry had been involved in and that she'd grown up in. But I knew, too, that there was something more, and I wasn't sure what it was. And one day, quite by chance, I was listening to one of the recordings of Henry Green broadcasting just before I went to see her, and Henry Green had a very loud and very distinctive laugh. He would suddenly burst into this explosive, booming, quite disproportionate laughter, which would then stop. And then I went to see Alice Keane, and in the middle of something, she laughed, and it was Henry's laugh. And I had known there was something, and I didn't say straight away, but at a certain point I asked her to talk about her father, who was supposed to have been a filmmaker called Bunny Keane. And she gradually said she wasn't really sure that Bunny was her father. And I said, who do you think might have been your father? And she said, oh, I don't have to say, do I? And so I left it, and then another time I went back and I said, do you think Henry was your father? And she said, yes, he was. But she wouldn't have told me, I'm sure, if I hadn't guessed and come around to it. That's hunches and damage. I felt I had to be careful, not in terms of Henry Green and his readers. One of the things that was fascinating to me about this was that ambiguous parentage, the possibility that siblings might marry by accident, these are themes in his novels. So all of a sudden, aspects of his work came into focus through finding out about this unacknowledged daughter. So in revealing her, I was able to make better sense of his books to myself and I hope to readers. I was also able to give her something of her life back in a way that she turned out to be grateful for. But I did have to be careful about his son, and not because of legal considerations or worries of that sort, though those were a difficulty, but because truths, difficult truths, can be so different in scale for those closely involved than they are for other people. You're absolutely right to say in the late 20th century, this isn't any great surprise, that isn't, we're used to this kind of thing. But actually, if you're the son of somebody or the daughter of somebody, the scale is quite different. And I'd had a warning of this, and I'll stop on this note, from a friend who I won't name, who is a well-known biographer, who is the daughter of a famous writer, and who, when somebody came to write about her father, did everything she could to stop it being a good biography because there were things she didn't want to be said about her father. And she knew, as a professional biographer, that everything she was doing was wrong. It was going to be bad for him, the biographer, it was going to be bad for the book, it was going to be bad, in a way, for the reputation of her father as a writer, because the book was going to come out less good. But as a human being, and as the daughter of this person, she would not let certain things be said. And it was in the knowledge of that that I felt that, you know, certain delicacy
was
called
for. Henry James' short story, that one. That's wonderful. A quick show of hands, how many of you have stood in the bookstore or the library in front of the shelf with the complete works X and decided to begin with the biography rather than the poems, the novels, the paintings? Dare you admit it? Yes, I know it happens.
That's a very respectable proportion. Three.
And can I invite you to ask any questions that you would like? Yeah.
Hi, just a question about writers. I was interested in whether you feel researching and writing about other people has influenced your own values and attitudes towards, for example, yourself and the world and aspects of you personally.
Could everybody hear that? The degree to which the writing of biographies has influenced our guests, speakers, in their own thoughts and values.
I think you should answer this too, because you're all the time working on the raw materials of writers, their letters, their diaries, their manuscripts. You give us a break. You start.
Well, I've spent the better part of the last decade with Christopher Isherwood's diaries open on the desk, at least for a few hours every day, sometimes more. And it has completely changed the inside of my imagination, living in London and sunny California. It's brightened things, and it's also stretched my imaginative sphere to include film stars, composers, Viennese refugees, all sorts of things. And I think not changed my values, but extended, I like to think, extended my capacity for sympathy with, I mean, after all, Isherwood is completely different from me, married, straight, mother now of three, none of which he was. And yet I feel a really profound affinity and even intimacy with a man who I only saw once ever alive in his life and never spoke to. So it certainly has changed me. I don't know if you...
I think it's a strange relationship. It's quite unlike any other that one has with a biographical subject. It begins, and people often say it's like a marriage, and in a sense it is, and marriages, of course, are very, very different. I have, two of my biographies were affairs of the heart. I fell in love at first sight, and the third was an arranged marriage. And in the end, I don't think it makes the faintest difference. I lived a long time with all of those people, and you know, the intensity of the relationship, it was not changed by how it had begun. One of its pleasures, I think, is that it comes to an end. I mean, a biography has a natural beginning, which is when you start work on it, and it also comes to an end when you finish it. I mean, they never actually leave your life. People still continue to contact you about them, and you may still make discoveries, but nonetheless, it has a very satisfactory shape, and I think the beginning and the end of it, and therefore the beginning of another one, is one of its great pleasures, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I'm not sure that my... well, perhaps my attitudes have been changed as they are by all one's reading and all one's experiences. But one of the great things, as an answer to your question, is that about biographies, you get to meet such interesting people who you wouldn't otherwise meet at all, because they're people who knew your subject or know about your subject, and you go and see them. So I met and stayed with... the beat novelist Terry Southern, who wrote Red Dirt Marijuana, for example, because he very improbably was a close friend of Henry Green at a late stage in Green's life. And I met Kitty Freud, Kitty Godley, the daughter of Jacob Epstein, the sculptor, and the first wife of Lucian Freud, who was the last serious girlfriend of Henry Green. Almost impossibly, one person, the same person, helped with two books, Roald Dahl and Henry Green. So it's very hard to imagine who would have Henry Green in common. Actually, Matthew Smith was one, but Isaiah Berlin was another. Isaiah Berlin knew them both. He knew Dahl because they were both in Washington together in the Second World War in intelligence. And I have a tape recording of lunch with Isaiah Berlin in a cafe called Cafe Rishu in Piccadilly, which has marble-topped tables and therefore clattering china and glass and background music. And Isaiah Berlin is talking in his inimitable, well, actually very imitable, but I won't try, gargle, about both writers dotting from one to the other. And in the course of the lunch, where there's these clanking plates and knives and forks and glasses, he gets hiccups and does the thing that you do with hiccups, which is to literally gargle with a glass of water upside down. And so my recording of Isaiah Berlin gargling with a glass of water upside down while talking about Roald Dahl and Henry Green indistinguishably, I think is something that I'll be able to donate to some archive.
It's perfectly clear that your next line should be Isaiah Berlin, and that will be your
well,
final.
It's been very well done by Michael Ignatieff, but I agree, a very tempting subject.
Have we got... Yeah?
Well, could I make a remark and ask a question, please? I mean, the remark would be you asked for a show of hands. I mean, that might be a little misleading about biography. As someone in the business of teaching literature, it seems to me that, particularly with some of the winds that have blown from the continent in the last part of the century, literary criticism has not always done good service to literature, great authors, or to the public out there. In many ways, what good biographers have done is to step into that space and more power at their elbow, say I. It's a great art to be able to do that well and to do it significantly. So that's the remark. The question is that one of the things that emerges, and I must say I found this very vivid in discussion, one of the things that emerges from it is the way you interact and are affected by the subject. And it seems to me that possibly every subject requires a different kind of biography. There's a person to write that, was the great case of, you know, Boswell and Johnson. It doesn't mean, of course, that you're like the person, that you identify with. So there's some, I mean, I was thinking recently reading George Boyle's big two-volume biography of Goethe. To write about Goethe, you've got to write about a whole age, a whole history. It can't be, in a sense, a personal thing, because that's how Goethe existed. And so, in some way, each biographer, like a novelist in a way, is having to create an arc for the individual subject. You see, that's what I'm picking up from some things you've been saying. I wonder if you think that's true. And is there an elective affinity? Were you at some early stage aware that there was something or other about this person that you needed to write about, or that the person needed you to write about them?
The thing that, all the three, I picked each of my biographical subjects as I thought it would be totally different, he or she would be totally different from the last one. And they all have turned out to be, in a sense, rather similar in that people said about all three of them they would be too dull to write about. They all three, the lives of all three, turned out to contain sensational secrets. And, well, just to answer your question technically, I think I now begin to see that there is a process in writing a biography, and I don't think it applies just to me, because I've done it often enough to see what the different stages are. The first one, of course, you start out, or I always start out, in a complete fog, knowing absolutely nothing. This is Matisse's advice, to start without preconceptions, and I think it's very wise advice, and the longer you can remain in that state, the longer you can prevent yourself forming any preconceptions, the better things will be, because once you... I mean, really the trick, I think, is formulating the questions. Once you ask the right questions, the answers can look after themselves. But if you don't ask the right questions, you will never, you know, you will never find the interesting answers. And that is not as easy as it sounds to do. But this is a first stage. Following your hunches, following your instincts. And for those early years, you are governed absolutely by the evidence you're able to unearth, and biography has its own rules of evidence which are as strict as those of a court of law, although very different. And this is a fascinating process, and it's one you must never rush, and it takes you to extraordinary places, or in my experience it always does, places you never expected to reach, and uncovers material you never expected. But it also has its laborious side. It's like, do you remember that shot from the Alec Guinness film, I've forgotten when, he says, you must leave no stone unturned, and there's a shot of him moodily, oh no, a couple of policemen moodily kicking at stones in some great stone yard. Well, basically that's what the first stage of biography is, leaving no stone unturned. The good thing about that is if you turn over every stone, you're always going to find something extraordinary. And most stones will have nothing under them, but some of them will have things you never expected. But then later on there's another process, and for me these processes are totally different. When you begin to formulate, to look at what you've found, to make some shape of it, and then to write it. And when you come to write a book, I think it has much in common, this isn't all that it is, but has much in common with an actor preparing to play a part, because when you're writing about somebody, of course you must remain completely objective. You have to take into account that the fact that you know what they thought they were doing, you know, or you should by this time know, what their nearest and dearest, their most intimate friends thought they were doing, what their most ferocious enemies thought they were doing, what casual acquaintances or people who only knew them in the office or only knew them because they saw them at the laundrette or whatever. You're seeing this person from all angles and in all lights and from all different points of view. But there must be a moment at which you try to look through their eyes. If you can't do that, then what was the point of ever beginning? And I think that is, from talking to actors and from, of course, watching actors on the stage, it's very comparable to taking on a role. And as in a lifetime one can see, I don't know, well, many great actors play Macbeth, play Lear, play Hamlet, and they will all be different. This is why you can have very different lives of different people, and should do. I mean, there can never be a definitive life. A life is, in fact, only a portrait, and the portrait painter will bring to it what he or she has to give but can't bring any more. And this is why different biographies of the same subject can be so different, and yet all equally good and all valid and all revelatory.
Yes, that's really, really interesting. I'm still sort of basking in the balm of having my work given this endorsement by my head of department. Thank you, Mike, very much. It's okay to do it. That's good to know. One has to be a bit careful about elective affinities, because actually people choose their subjects in part because their subjects are there, and a lot of it is like how you get a job. There are various jobs you want that you don't get, and then there's another job which doesn't necessarily at first sight seem right, and then it comes right. That's been so in my case at any rate. I guess I have found myself writing, if I count Rochester as well, about three men whose writers are, whose work I very much admired. Of course, that's one of the affinities. But have all had extremely untidy lives, and perhaps if one can't make sense of one's own life in its untidiness, one can have a shot at somebody else's. Yeah. And I am interested at the moment in trying to do the opposite of that, which is possibly to write about somebody, I don't at the moment want to say who, but whose life, as far as I know, was impeccable, exemplary in domestic terms and professional terms, and therefore a lot of people would say impossible to write interestingly. I mean, who was it who said happiness writes white? And seeing whether that can be made interesting. Of course, I'm rather afraid that, as tends to happen with biographies, that one will turn a stone and find that it wasn't all so perfect after all.
We have to hope
I have that fear too. I often feel as though I'm handing out the black spot, you know, in Treasure Island, that awful moment when the blind man comes tapping through the fog in the first chapter. Well, frankly, whenever I pick a new biographical subject, I feel exactly like that, that I'm tapping through the fog and at the same time tipping the black spot, because I know that I will discover things people really didn't want me to, and that's because human life contains dark parts. All human lives, I think, contain dark parts, and you can't write somebody's life if you're only going to favour the light part. This is the French theory, and that's why their biographies are no good. French literature is a very, very great and amazing structure, but biography is one of its nasty, dark little rooms in which very little has occurred.
Yes, up there.
I just wanted to ask how you've ever come across a situation where you want to write about somebody and they've already written a finished biography, or you were able to use in that situation, another biographer, and you said how you handle that, so more than just looking at different.
My subjects have all been far too oblique to write autobiography. My first subject, Ivy Compton Burnett, knew far too much. I learned an awful lot from her. But she certainly didn't want a biography. She said her life was too dull to write about. She destroyed all her papers. There were none. There was about a shoebox about half full of letters, which I got to see, and they were mostly odd fan letters that she'd forgotten to destroy. That was the total documentary side of my research for Ivy. But I'll tell you a short horror story. I was commissioned to write that life by Livia Gollancz, who was the daughter of Victor Gollancz, Ivy's lifelong publisher, and therefore Ivy's publisher herself. And simultaneously, without telling me, Livia Gollancz commissioned somebody else to write the life of Ivy Compton Burnett. Well, I didn't know that. I left my job. I resigned. And after about 6 months, I discovered that there was somebody else on the same trail, and I discovered it by talking to the woman to whom Ivy had left all her chattels, that's to say the contents of her flat, everything. And it was another precautionary measure, because this woman, leaving your stuff to her, was like scattering it on the sea. She's dead now, the most scatterbrained individual I have ever come across. And Ivy knew perfectly well that if by mistake there were the contents of some waste paper basket that she'd forgotten to get rid of, her friend Hester would do it for her just in the natural course of events. Anyway, we were having a discussion. Things were going well. We were talking about
Ivy's brother, whom she had adored all her life, her closest brother, who had been killed in the Battle of the Somme, and for Ivy that was almost the end of everything. She then caught the great 1918 flu and nearly died, and she didn't want to live, basically. It was the end of her life. And there was no way one could reconstruct this relationship. And Hester suddenly said, oh, you have to remember that Ivy left no letters of any kind. Hester suddenly said, and what about those two letters from Noel that he'd written on the eve of the Battle of the Somme? And I said, what? Two letters? She said, ah, I promised Elizabeth I wouldn't tell you. I said, Elizabeth? And that is how I discovered that someone else was writing the life of Ivy Compton Burnett. And even stranger than this, it turned out that she lived opposite me. We lived in Ladbrook Grove, she and I, on opposite sides of the road. And for 6 months, Ivy's friends had been going to tea with her and crossing the road and having drinks with me and going home and ringing each other up and telling each other what a lot of stories they had spun to both of us. Or they would have, I don't know, lunch with me and cross the road and have tea with her and once again, etc. And I would actually have resigned under those circumstances. Elizabeth Sprigg, dead now, was a very senior biography, had written many biographies. What I didn't know then was that this had happened to her again and again. When she wrote The Life of Cocteau at the same time as, who was it, Francis Stiegmuller wrote The Definitive Life of Cocteau. She wrote A Life of Ibsen when Michael Meyer was beginning his, again, Definitive Life of Ibsen. She wrote A Life of Gertrude Stein. I mean, always this had happened to her. So I perfectly see how infuriated she must have been to discover that somebody else, she knew from the beginning. But it was because she had made everybody promise not to talk to me, I was just so angry about that I did not give up. If she had written to me and said to me to my face, my dear, you know, you are young, you are innocent, you know nothing, you have no experience. I am experienced, I'm a biographer, and I knew Ivy, I would immediately have resigned. It would have been pointless. I wasn't even convinced I was going to be a biographer. It's what Jeremy was talking about. That wasn't my great aim in life. Anyway, I was so angry that I continued. Her book came out very quickly. Mine came out in two large volumes very slowly. Hers, I have to say, was pretty dull because she took Ivy at face value. Mine was not dull. It was full of very surprising and melodramatic secrets.
Yes.
There's two points I'd like to raise. Since both of you have written about subjects whose work was in creative arts, the first point raised particularly directed at Miss Sterling. Two of your subjects worked in the literary arts. So you had their works, their working words together. But Matisse, even though he may have written that painting, the essential channel communication of what he drew and painted. Could you talk a little bit about the difference of working with a subject like that? I'm just thinking how inordinate it would be to be a composer and a musical.
Yes.
So, and the second point I'd like to raise is my besetting irritation with literary biographers is that they have so often exhibit a holistic tendency. They want to make the different parts of the person, the different parts of the jigsaw puzzle, fit together. They want to find the golden key that unlocks the door to their life and its meaning. Yet we all know in real life that people are full of contradictions and the jagged pieces that don't fit together should be left in the biography if they're to be true to the life.
I think I'll leave that second subtle question for Jeremy to answer, since you asked me the first question. I'll answer that. Which was? I was thinking about your second one, so I've forgotten. Oh, that's right, yes. I too thought this would be a huge and probably insuperable problem because, as you say, when you're writing about a writer, you can take you're writing in the same medium, and so you can use extracts, quotations, quite directly, which, of course, you can't do with the painting. But in fact, there were huge difficulties, almost insuperable, in writing The Life of Matisse. One was the French, I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 with French attitudes, I suppose. But it turned out when I came to write it, it didn't make any difference. And I didn't find that it did, that I was using a different medium. And I think this is actually because paintings have meant as much to me all my life as books. And I have lived in them as much and responded to them as intensely. And so, given that I'm not a writer of genius, that I'm neither a novelist nor a painter, that I have to make an imaginative leap to enter the lives of any of these people, it was not more difficult to do that for Matisse than it was or would have been for a writer. And nor, actually, when I first wrote about a man, having first written about Ivy, I mean, Ivy was a woman, I suppose, they're not a woman like other women, but people said, oh, you won't be able to write about a man, and I too thought that might be difficult. But in the end, the difference in sex is almost the least important difference between me and Paul Scott, or me and Matisse. I'm not a great writer, I'm not a great painter, I have to make that imaginative leap. The fact that I also have to imagine I'm a different gender turned out to be a very sort of minor point. So no, I didn't find that, although I thought I would, a practical difficulty. Now I leave the difficult question to Jeremy to answer.
Well, alas, there's not much time left, or perhaps it's a relief there's not much time left. And I'm very hesitant about dealing in a short time with a subject raised by Ian Smith, a notable biographer in himself. But I will claim not to try to iron out contradictions in my own subjects. And since we began reading from our own work, I'll read you a couple of sentences from the beginning of my book about Roald Dahl. Quite outside his writing, yet in ways which inevitably affected it, he was an intriguing, contradictory figure. He was famously a war hero, a connoisseur, a philanthropist, and a devoted family man who had to confront an appalling succession of tragedies. He was also, as will be seen, a fantasist, an anti-Semite, a bully, and a self-publicizing troublemaker. Although he had a voice of his own as a writer, he was not above taking credit for others' ideas. Many people loved him and had reason to be grateful to him. Many, some of them the same people, frankly detested him.
Sadly, we're going to have to stop with that question. But I'd just like to say, despite self-deprecation on both sides, that I think it cannot be underestimated the skill with which all of these books have been written. When I find myself being absolutely gripped by the the yeomen of yore who come long before I ever get to Ivy Compton Burnett, and I feel this is so important. And you know, the boys at Eton and the sports they played and which day it wasn't required. I mean, how you give excitement to these details which then build up into the life. I think that is a great gift to be able to do that. And these are wonderful books and hardworking, wonderful researchers and writers we have here. So do come up and chat informally if you have any more pressing questions that we didn't have time to get to. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.